Welcome to The Road to Now, where we look to the past
and everywhere in between
to understand the present.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and in today's episode of The Road to Now, we're actually going to try to fill the gaps in something that happened recently. I don't know if you saw it, but a few days ago, the President of the United States invited the Navajo Code Talkers into the White House, and he said a lot of things, but one of the things he didn't say was why the Code Talkers were important and what they did for our country. And he didn't seem to represent a very thorough knowledge of the contributions of Native Americans. In fact, he used some names of Native Americans in negative ways. So in today's episode of The Road to Now, we're speaking with Dr. Ashley Riley Sousa, a colleague of mine at Middle Tennessee State University, a specialist in Native American history, to dig deeper, understand what the president said, what the Code Talkers did, and why maybe the problems that you've heard about in the media, why they matter.
Dolph Ramser began his record label in his hometown of Concord, North Carolina, where he continues the tradition of delivering new and inspiring music to audiences worldwide. Nowhere else can you get albums from Jim Avett, David Childers, Josh White, and Sammy Walker. Visit ramserrecords.kungfustore.com and use the promo code HISTORY at checkout.
Ashley Riley Sousa, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're happy that you could join us today because recently in the news, we saw a moment in which President Donald Trump invited some of the Code Talkers, the Navajo Code Talkers, to the White House, and in the process made a big moment in the media by using that opportunity to mock Elizabeth Warren and then to basically say very little about the Code Talkers.
You're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special.
Now, whatever your politics are, I think that's an insulting thing. But for me, I felt like the moment that was supposed to be for these Native Americans who served our country, who helped us defeat the Nazis, it took a moment that was supposed to be for them, and it made another moment about Donald Trump. And so we're grateful, Bob and I, we felt like we should serve some justice to this and do this episode, and we're grateful you're here today. So could you start off by telling us a little bit about the Navajo Code Talkers and what they did in World War II?
Sure. So the Navajo Code Talkers were part of a Marine Corps program to basically try to circumvent Japanese code breaking by using the Navajo language, which is sort of famously difficult to learn and at the time had not been written down, right? No German anthropologists had studied it. And so these radio men were sort of trained to use certain Navajo words to represent particular military terminology and then relay messages in a way that couldn't be understood by the Japanese.
Another factor with what happened at the White House a few days ago was that this ceremony took place under the watchful eye of Andrew Jackson. So, you know, it's funny, I was talking to someone today on the radio about this, and he said, well, it must have been a mistake. Right? It's the terrible optics, very tone deaf. Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe it wasn't, given this president's self-proclaimed kindred connection to Andrew Jackson. But explain to our listeners why that was that could be perceived as a faux pas.
Right. So Andrew Jackson, his presidency, I think for most Americans, it's hard for me to know, right, being a historian, what normal people think. But I think for most Americans, his presidency is really closely associated with the policy of Indian removal. I think most people are familiar with the Cherokee Trail of Tears, which took place in the 1830s, which was a product of Andrew Jackson's Indian policy, which focused on removing removing Indian tribes out of sort of regions that white Americans wanted to settle.
So Ashley, I'm gonna interrupt kindly and interrupt you. Let's talk about the Trail of Tears. Like, maybe all of our listeners don't know about the Trail of Tears. Go into a little detail about exactly what it was and how brutal it was.
Right. So the Trail of Tears was basically the forced march of the Cherokee Nation, or the vast majority of the Cherokee Nation, out of their traditional homelands in Georgia, Tennessee, and North Carolina to Indian territory in what's present-day Oklahoma. The Cherokees resisted it vigorously from the point in which this fraudulent treaty was negotiated in 1835, that sort of gave the government an excuse, the U.S. government an excuse to say, oh, see, they've ceded their homeland. They're willing to go, when in fact that wasn't the case. And the majority of the Cherokee Nation was rounded up at gunpoint, put in military stockades and held, and then eventually sort of forced to evacuate under terrible circumstances of starvation and disease, and lost, I believe, if I'm remembering the statistics correctly, about a quarter of their population as a result of the forced removal.
And all of this carried out by Andrew Jackson against the will of the Supreme Court of the United States, correct?
Right. Was it John Marshall who was the Chief Justice at the time?
So Indian removal really kind of, it's all kind of a piece, but the actual Trail of Tears was not the subject of the Supreme Court decision that Andrew Jackson famously disregarded. Okay. The Supreme Court decision that of Worcester versus Georgia in 1832, that Andrew Jackson disregarded, you know, he's sort of rumored to have said, Chief Justice John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, was actually a case that was over whether or not the state of Georgia had the authority to exert its legal jurisdiction over the Cherokee Nation, which was technically protected under treaty law, or protected by treaty, when the Supreme Court declared that no, Georgia does not have the right to force non-Indians to carry passports, you know, to enter into Cherokee territory. Then, you know, Andrew Jackson was like, yeah, so what are you going to do about it?
Is it possible that had the president been very respectful during this ceremony the other day and didn't kind of inject himself and his own personal feelings, or, you know, make that, you know, by making the Pocahontas comment, is it possible that today we would be saying, wow, it's really great that these men were honored under the eye of Andrew Jackson? Just kind of a thing of, look how far we've come.
So, you know, Andrew Jackson is a historical villain for most Native people, and rightly so. I'm not going to try to deny that he is not awful in that way. But I mean, what president from the 19th century would you have a portrait hanging of in the White House, in the Oval Office, before which you could host a Native American audience? I mean, I can't think of a single one that where you would be like, yes, this is not problematic. Like, this guy had great politics when it came to Indian policy, right? So I don't want to defend Andrew Jackson, but I do want to acknowledge that that he is not uniquely evil, perhaps, in that regard. Evil, so I'm using like really morally loaded language, but he's not, you know, he's sort of like not uniquely on a spectrum of bad, right? Maybe he's a little bit more to one end, but I don't think you could have a single 19th century and probably very few 20th century presidents where you could say like, yeah, this guy's portrait should hang in front of a Indian audience in the Oval Office.
And the butt of the president's joke that was in terrible taste, the derogatory comment, the racial epithet, if you will, was Elizabeth Warren. What is she accused of doing? And does what she may have done offend Native Americans?
Right. So Elizabeth Warren has been accused of fabricating her Native American ancestry, right? At some point when she was in law school, I believe, she had asserted that she had Native American, I believe, Cherokee ancestry. You know, she is not an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation or the Eastern Band Cherokee. But like many, many people who would be identified as white, who come from the South or the Southeast, there are family stories about Native American ancestry. My family insisted that, yes, you know, of course we were Cherokee. This was a well-known fact in my family until a well-timed ancestry DNA test proved otherwise, right? Totally disabused us of that notion. So, you know, she didn't claim to be like, hey, I am Cherokee. I'm an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation. She claimed to have this ancestry. And those are two different things. Being the citizen of a nation is different than having ancestry, right? So we can't prove or disprove whether or not Elizabeth Warren has Native ancestry. We can prove or disprove whether or not she's an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation or the Eastern Band Cherokee. So this kind of got her in hot water, because I think that both for Native people who, tribal nations who guard their right to determine who does and doesn't belong to their nations, they guard it, very protectively. And I think also for sort of Americans at large who really like their Indians to be authentic, this was sort of like, oh, look, yeah, she's a fake Indian, right? So there's that. And I feel like she retreated back off of that, right, to sort of say like, oh, this is just a thing that we know in my family. Like, I wasn't claiming to be, more than I am. But of course, this became for Donald Trump a way to sort of call her a liar, right, and like sort of point out her dishonesty. By calling her Pocahontas, that's gross and troubling on several levels, not least of which, to my mind, is the fact that to sort of characterize Pocahontas, who's a real historical figure, she's not simply a Disney character, to characterize her in sort of a dismissive fashion, like a person without substance, right? Just sort of like this image of an Indian, is to really do a disservice to her important historical legacy. I mean, she was a diplomat. She helped broker an alliance between colonial Jamestown and the Powhatan Confederacy. And she also, sort of had this very tragic life as a result. She had to marry the Englishman John Rolfe in order to make this happen. And she ended up, dying at a very, very young age and is buried in England, never to return to her people. So to sort of choose her as the person to say a dismissive sort of offhand comment about is, sad.
It sounds like politically, maybe Elizabeth Warren's response should have been to say, yeah, I'm Pocahontas.
Like, that would be the highest compliment, right? The highest political compliment you could give, really.
Right.
Like, you're a skilled negotiator, right? You're somebody who brings people together. So Trump clearly misunderstands Pocahontas's history. And then also sort of like the idea that you can sort of like insultingly like pick an Indian caricature, which I'm sure he was thinking of the Disney character, right? Pick this insulting Indian caricature and kind of throw it out as an insult.
So Pocahontas is from the East. She's associated with Jamestown, early Virginia, early 17th century. And what's interesting to me is like, and I was wondering this as I was watching it, Navajo are from the other side of the continent, right? I mean, they're primarily in modern New Mexico and Arizona, right? So I wonder sometimes when we look at it and we look at the way that we talk about Jackson, for example, who's a figure in the early 19th century and primarily associated with the five tribes in the Southeast, or Pocahontas, who's from the East, is there a problem with conflating these all under the category of Native American when their experiences are so fundamentally different?
I mean, more problematic than simply sort of casting out racist insults. I mean, sure, right? I think there's like a common sort of acceptance in America that an Indian is an Indian, right? And so you can insult somebody who claims to be Cherokee by, calling her the name of a Pamunkey, elite in a speech that's, supposed to be like relevant to people who are from the far West. I mean, yeah, that's sort of like this idea that an Indian is an Indian and there's kind of like all the same, which, nothing could be further from the truth. So yeah, I mean, it really speaks to how little Donald Trump knows, that he doesn't even know, I guess, or doesn't appreciate what kind of hot water he's treading into, or doesn't care.
He loves hot.
You heard it here,
he
folks.
Loves it. He loves the hot water.
He does love
he
the
loves
hot
the
water.
Hot water. He thrives on it. He's one of these figures that he's a vile character that shows us the ugliness of ourselves, because he does things that provoke every group, most groups, unless you're a white supremacist or you're Russian or you're overtly supportive of him, he will provoke you and then you will respond aggressively and in kind. And then you will reflect on that and realize how ugly you are. You know what I'm saying? That I mean, I'm speaking from my personal visceral interaction with him every day, reading the news. I condemn what he says. I condemn those who enable him to say it. And then within minutes, I reflect on my own anger and I see the ugliness of myself and I realize I'm no better. And so we are just faced with this character at this moment in history. Can you, Ashley, explain how the Native American people went from the Trail of Tears to becoming code talkers?
Oh my gosh, that's a huge question.
Just fill that 100 years in there for us real quick.
We got how long do we have? Well, you know,
and I've got to pick up my kids in about 20 minutes from
all
school.
Right.
So just no, I'm just kidding.
I'll give you the quick and dirty.
But yeah, no, really.
Just kidding, but no, seriously, hurry up. But no, 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 take your time, but seriously, hurry up.
So, you know, we're talking about two different tribal nations here. So, you know, a lot of the Indian policy that impacts the Cherokees in the early 19th century that culminates in the Trail of Tears is not necessarily the same sort of trends in Indian policy exactly that are going to later on impact the Navajo. What I will say is this, sort of at the beginning of the 20th century, Native American people have been enmeshed for a generation in this assimilation program that the federal government has sort of been coercing and forcing Indian people to participate in, right? Indian children, in some cases, have been like forcibly removed from their homes and taken to boarding schools. Certainly, you know, many others were encouraged, strenuously encouraged to attend. Reservations were being broken up into private land holdings that were then sort of dispersed, you know, among tribal members. The idea was that you could sort of put an end to Indian as a category and sort of assimilate Indian people into the mainstream of American life. And this happened unevenly. It happened certainly from the perspective of policymakers unsuccessfully. But what it did was it opened up, in many cases, opportunities for Indian people to sort of engage with sort of like the mainstream of American life, right? In being educated at boarding schools, in being literate, in being able to communicate with broader audiences. We see in the early 20th century sort of a whole generation of Native people come of age who can do things like, you know, engage in public activism on behalf of their people. World War II kind of like dovetails into this trend in that it is the first time for a lot of Native people that they leave the reservation and go take off reservation employment. Native people have a long history of service in the American Armed Forces, so that in and of itself was not necessarily new, but to the scope of it was new, right? This total national mobilization for war. Historians kind of identify this as like sort of the moment where, you know, Indian people kind of come into a fuller contact with the larger American society. So it's not surprising that the Navajo Nation sends so many young men into combat. I want to say that about 8,000 Navajo serve in the armed forces. So, you know, it's a large nation, but, you know, this in this context of total national mobilization for war, totally not surprising. So you have, you know, within these military units, like large is relative here, but large numbers of Native people serving with other Americans, serving kind of in units with each other, who can do things like put together a group of Navajo large enough to, you know, establish a unit of signalmen capable of pulling off this code.
So this was interesting to me because a lot of people don't know this, but the United States Armed Forces were segregated. You know, black regiments were segregated in World War II. It wasn't until the Korean War that you see the first ones kind of come into effect. How does that affect Native Americans? Because I know from the work of our friend Joe Jordan Palau, the Ely Parker himself, who Ely Parker is one of Grant's tightest, you know, one of a central group of officers, with his own hand writes the surrender at Appomattox. This amazing figure. But he himself was denied education. He himself was denied multiple times by William Seward, the Secretary of the State, to be led into the U.S. Army as an officer. And finally, he's able to come around it. How is the policy there? Because I think we're more familiar with the policy regarding race when it comes to black and white. So how is this affect Native Americans?
So one of the interesting things about the Native American experience during World War II, both in the armed forces and on the home front, is that there is no official policy of segregation that, you know, forces Native people into, segregated employment or segregated units like African Americans experienced during the war. So during World War II, you know, I say that like this sort of is a moment that brings like so many Native Americans into fuller contact with the larger American society. Well, it's also a moment that brings white Americans into much fuller contact with Native Americans, you know, who may in the past have existed in the minds of most white folks as, you know, people of the past or, you know, sort of caricatures, who then, you know, are more fully human in the minds of a lot of white Americans.
And so does this, after the war in particular, their contribution, because the Navajo code talkers, I mean, they have an unbreakable code, right? I mean, a lot of World War II, when you've got these signals going through the air, if you can break someone's code, you can bring them down. With the Germans have the Enigma machine. Eventually, we cracked the code on that end, but you can't crack the Navajo language because it's its own thing. There is this singular contribution that particularly the Navajo make. How do they, do you know how they assert that claim? How do they use that to make claims for belonging in American society after the war?
Well, I can't speak specifically with respect to the Navajo Nation particularly, but I can say that very generally, World War II, because of the sacrifice, because of the heroic service, because of really like the specialized sets of skills that Native people can bring into combat situations, and also in the home front in war industries, one of the significant contributions that Native people were able to make is that through vocational training in the boarding schools, many Native students were highly qualified to work in wartime industries because of their specialized vocational training. So with all this sacrifice in mind, with all this like hard work and expertise in mind, like a lot of Native people during World War II did what a lot of other sort of marginalized groups did during and coming out of World War II, which is to say, hey, we have done like everybody else or more than anybody else to further this war effort, to support this country, and we demand to be treated equally within it and have our rights honored like anybody else's. So we see, for example, in, I believe, 1944, the National Congress of American Indians is formed out of this sort of idea that, hey, like we've been in it with the rest of America and it's time that we were treated accordingly. So it becomes this major sort of Native American civil rights organization that, in fact, is still active today. The president of the National Congress of American Indians criticized Donald Trump, specifically pointing out the portrait of Andrew Jackson and how offensive that is.
Is there a Native American hero who we don't know his or her name?
Associated particularly with World War II or just in general?
No, I mean, just I think a lot of Americans don't know a lot about Native American history, particularly in the 20th century, in the early 21st century. And there is a cultural history there, and it's a part of our greater context as a nation, the patchwork quilt that is the United States. Who are some of the heroes that we just don't know their names? Like Ben mentioned Ely Parker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never knew about him. I never knew about him. And he's a great Native American icon, is the way I look at him now. I know Jim Thorpe, you know, but I feel personally very, very ignorant of Native American history. And I'm sure there are some people that I should know their names.
Well, this is another one of those, you know, how long do we have kind of questions? Like, are your kids going to be okay? It's funny that you say that, especially like as a historian, right? Like, I'm so reluctant to talk in terms of heroes. Villains are much easier to talk about, I think, as a historian. It's a lot more difficult to talk about heroes. But I do think that people don't know a lot of individual sort of like Indian figures. Even a lot of my students, when I talk about Pocahontas, they're like, wait, whoa, she's real? Like, that's not just a Disney movie? So, you know, even taking somebody like Pocahontas, who is, I think, like arguably a very heroic figure, making her a real human being in people's minds, right? So let's just start with the people with the figures that people know but don't think are real. You know, when I think of sort of like prominent heroic Indian figures, and again, with all the caveats about, you know, heroism and sort of casting people in that way. You know, I think like if you look back to the colonial era, certainly there are so many Indian figures that stand out as people who, you know, brokered peaceful relations between colonists and their people. You know, there are figures associated with resistance to various Indian policies, like Indian removal, right? John Ross, the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, often emerges as a heroic figure in sort of leading and really strenuous resistance against removal. That's not a name I think that most folks are familiar with. A lot of figures of military resistance, I think people are more familiar with. I think of like Geronimo, right, who led the Apache resistance against the U.S. Army, or you know, a figure like Crazy Horse, a, you know, Oglala Lakota figure like Crazy Horse, who, you know, led military resistance against the U.S. Army. So, you know, yeah, we could be here all day. but, you know, in the 20th century or sort of more recently, I think of figures like Wilma Mankiller, who was the first woman principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, you know, beloved figure. Yeah, I mean, we could be here all day.
So Ashley, I've known you for a while. You're my colleague here at MTSU. You know, here's the thing about Ashley. You're from California, yeah? And then you went to grad school at Yale, and then you came to work at MTSU. And that's three different parts of the world you travel to become a historian of Native and stay in this field as a Native American historian. What got you interested in this?
You know, growing up in California, so you say this like I've traveled all over the U.S. and sort of like broadened my horizons, but actually my historical interests are terribly provincial. Growing up in California, every California public school kid in the fourth grade does a unit on California Indian history. And I'm embarrassed to say that my interest in Native American history stems from having to read in fourth grade the novel Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell, which is a fictionalized account of the lone woman of San Nicolas Island, who was a California Indian woman who her entire community who lived on this island off Southern California were rounded up and brought into the California mission system, and she was left behind. And it sort of tells the story of her survival alone on this island over a period of years. And I probably did what like any little girl does when they read a book like that, which is you immediately imagine that you are that little girl, right? You immediately are like, I'm setting up my desert island right now. And so, you know, I spent an embarrassing amount of time imagining myself to be the protagonist in that novel. So, you know, any time after that,
it's a good book, right?
Fantastic book. So kind of from that point forward, sort of everything that I learned about California Indians, you know, I sort of thought back to fourth grade and that interest that I had in that book. And Indians are people of the past in California as they are sort of, you know, perceived that way in California as they are elsewhere in the United States. And so the more I learned, especially college and beyond, about California Indians, the sort of the more intrigued I was, and also like the more outraged I was. There's nothing like righteous outrage for a college student, you know, like the more righteously outraged I was that like, hey, why didn't I ever learn about this? Like, this is crazy. So that kind of, I think, got me going on that path.
It is interesting because I feel like I myself, to like my personal experience of feeling like I was brainwashed during the Cold War and then finding out that the communists were as afraid of the Americans as the Americans were of the communists, which everything's wrong about that sentence I just said. It's always amazing how our personal stories lead there.
Yeah, I often ask myself, what was the solution when the Europeans came to the New World? The British, you know, established and settled much of the United States. And what was, and the Spanish in California, what was the solution with the Native Americans? The Europeans weren't going to stop. The British weren't going to stop. And it was it's an ugly, brutal history. I mean, it's just, there's no way to smooth it over, right? There's nothing good about what we as Americans did to the native people of this land. But what was a better way to handle it?
You know, to a certain extent, to a huge extent, violence is built into colonialism. So I think, like, you know, the ultimate solution is like, stay home, Europeans. the historian Alan Taylor wrote a really great line that I'm going to poorly attempt to restate for you here. But he wrote in describing the success that the British had in colonizing the eastern coast of North America, that something to the effect that the British were so good at colonizing in North America precisely because they were so bad at taking care of British people back home. Right. So there's like a desperation, especially for the British, that fuels this colonization. And so I think the solution, oddly enough, is just take better care of your people. Right. Go back in time. Get your time machine. Go back in time. Don't have poor British people be dying in the streets, and then you won't have desperate British people clamoring to get to North, you know, I mean, oversimplifying it here. The violence is built into colonialism. I don't think there's any way to say like, yes, we're going to come over and lay claim to your territory, and we're not going to end up having to fight over this.
Ashley, really, thank you for doing this so last minute.
Oh yeah, no problem at all. This has been fun.
Ben, thank you so much.
Bob, thank you so much. The Road to Now is hosted by Bob Crawford and Benjamin Sawyer and produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Our associate editor is Megan Summers.
Today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Eric King, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and Jeff LeCain. And just a reminder, if you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.